So I would like to welcome everyone that's was able to attend over here and online to the Texas State University Physics Podcast. This is our first episode with Dr. Kip Thorne. The TCU Physics Podcast, it's called Beyond the Equation. And our main point over here, our main focus is to explore the frontiers of science with some of the greatest minds in the field of physics, of course. This podcast is dedicated to inspiring, educating, and improving our community by bringing world-renowned scientists to share their insight, discoveries, and personal journey. Today, as all of you know, we share this honor of hosting one of the most brilliant theoretical physicists of our time, a scientist who's profoundly shaped our understanding of the universe, Dr. Kip Thorne. Of course, everybody knows Dr. Kip Thorne, Nobel Prize-winning physicist, a visionary in gravitational physics and astrophysics, and a key architect behind the historical discovery of the gravitational waves. Kip have been for decades pushing the boundaries of theoretical physics, and we can say that his contribution led to the foundation of the LIGO experiment, the one that's achieved the discovery of gravitational waves, that we can say 100 years prediction from the general relativity. Kip is also a passionate science communicator, known for his role in shaping the science behind the box office hit film Interstellar. And today we have the great opportunity to hear directly from Kip. And his journey, scientific journey, his successes and his achievements, and also where we are going in the field of gravity. So, Kip, welcome to Beyond the Equations.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
It's our pleasure to host you today and to be our first speaker. That's a great happiness from Texas Southern University, which is a historical Black university. You know, I have been doing this kind of talk some time with some scientists, and I found that there was one question that we all answered differently. However, you have thousands around the world doing physics, and every time I ask the question, I get a different answer. And this question is related to what's physics mean to us. It seems like it has a personal perspective, it has a story behind it to tell, and also when you reach some particular level, it has your own point of view about the world. So I would like to ask you, what's physics mean to Kip Thorne?
Well, physics is for me a way to understand the universe around us. I'm curious. Ever since I was a small child, I wanted to understand. And physics is the fundamental tool together with mathematics, because mathematics is the language in which the laws of physics are written. Physics is a springboard for moving in many, many different directions. When I educate students throughout my career, I would make clear to them that they have huge numbers of options. They can spring from physics into basically any other field of science that they want to go into, or they can move into the application of physics to societal issues. There are so many options. So that's fundamentally what it means to me.
That's great to hear. And also, you know, after all of this experience, how you vision the world? Like, did physics or understanding the gravitational force, the gravitational fields, and so on, did shape your understanding of our universe or the world around you?
I think I would certainly it had changed my understanding in terms of the universe around us, but also in terms of everyday life. Once I got into physics, I came to understand that it is the tool for understanding how wind behaves, how leaves rustle in the wind, for understanding how molecules move, how paramecium propel themselves through water, for understanding basically everything that we see, for being at the beach and seeing the large waves roll in rapidly, and the tiny waves, they move ever so much more slowly, and why, and what's going on there. It's just you look around yourself in any direction and you see things happening that in the natural world, and physics is the tool for understanding them. And that, in many ways, means has meant more to me than the deep issues about understanding the universe at great distances from Earth.
That's great to hear. As you said, basically you can in like picture or understand everything around you in terms of some physical phenomena to the core of it. And that's bring me actually to my next point. You graduated as an undergrad from Caltech, and then you went to Princeton for the graduate school. But how you get initially in physics? Like usually one problem we face sometimes is to convince students that physics don't bite. You can understand the world around you. You can love it. You can understand everything better around you if you decide to study physics. So how Kip Thorne get into, I want to study physics?
Well, when I was small, growing up in a Logan, Utah town, fairly high up in the mountains, Rocky Mountains, the snow was deep. The snow plows would drive the snow up to a height three times higher than my father's height. And so it was obvious the most powerful job in the world was be a snow plow driver. And that's what I wanted to do until mother took me to a lecture at the local church about the solar system. And I fell in love with the idea of the planets going around the sun. And she helped me do a scale model of the solar system. We drew a 4-foot circle on the corner on the sidewalk in front of our house, and then laid out the planets from there, their sizes relative to that sun. And that circle was the sun, and the Earth was on down in front of about the third house down the street, and Pluto was out in the next town. It wasn't even in our town. And seeing that, I was just totally enchanted that there could be so much space out there between the planets and how the planets moved. And then a few years later, I found in a used bookstore a book called 1, 2, 3 Infinity by a cosmologist, a Russian cosmologist, George Gamow. And I read in there that the thing that controls the planets and controls, in fact, everything around us, controls the universe, is the laws of physics. And so I immediately wanted to understand the laws of physics and curious about them, what they are, how they arose. So at that point, I think I was 13 years old, and I never lost that curiosity. I decided at that point that's what I wanted to do with my life, and so that's what I've done.
That's great. So basically, a small thing could inspire people that they want to learn about the world around them. They want to know more about physics.
I think we're all very curious when we're children. Fortunately, I had a mother who preserved that curiosity and inspired her kids to really dig in to understand the things they were curious about. And so having maintained a child's curiosity as I grew into adulthood was very central to my not being afraid of physics. In fact, just seeing physics is the way to feed my curiosity.
That's great. That's basically, you know, as I said, everyone has his own picture to how things happening around them, and sometimes it shapes their future too. And this, your story, how you get to physics, and then it's pretty much, I think, also how you get into gravitational field, like working on the part. And as I said, like we tried sometime to recruit students who would like to tell them, guys, physics is important, physics is interesting, everything around you is physics. So I was happy to hear your story about it. And hopefully, I think it will inspire a lot of our undergraduates into physics. But then, you know, going to grad school myself, I went to Stony Brook, New York. You went to Princeton for your grad school. And we all face hard times. We go there, full of passion, everything will be smooth, everything will be good. And then we face, you know, the difficulties of grad school and then the difficulties of doing research. And to me personally, research is about how many times you fail before you found the good answer or the correct answer. So to you, what's the challenges that you faced in your research, or if you want to mention a general idea about it?
Well, let me go back. The first big challenge, the first big dislocation was just going to undergraduate school. I thought I was kind of smart when I was in high school, and I went to Caltech for undergraduate school. I discovered that all the other students were smarter than I was. Their minds worked more quickly was the key point, that I learned much more slowly than other people did. And so I had to find my own ways to learn things more deeply so I wouldn't have to relearn them the next year or 3 years later. And the main thing I developed for dealing with that was I started to keep notebooks in which I wrote down in my own words, my own way, the most important things I'd learned, mostly about physics, but also about mathematics or any things that were complicated and the things that I wanted to really learn. Write them down in my own words. If there was a derivation, then make up my own derivation in my own way. So make these things my part of myself. And that way, I not only had the notebooks to fall back on the following year or many years later, but I also had lodged them in my mind by doing that. So that basically was the thing. It took me a year and a half to get my feet under myself, but I was really struggling for the first year and a half of undergraduate school. Fortunately, graduate school was different in that you didn't feel like everybody else was right there alongside you, competing with you, which I didn't like, and which I tried to shove out of my mind. But in graduate school, we each went off in our own directions on our own research projects, and it was a much more joyous thing. Throughout my career, early in my career, I learned this from my PhD advisor, John Wheeler, in his words, the best physicists tend to be the ones who make the most mistakes the most rapidly on their way toward the truth. And if you're afraid of making mistakes, then you're never going to go anywhere. Mistakes are a major part of learning. The mistakes are the major part of digging more deeply into things. And that has truly been my experience.
It's very inspiring to hear it. I remember from my grad school when I was afraid for the same thing, coming from Egypt to grad school here in Stony Brook, my advisor had to tell me, perfection is the enemy of good. Don't wait for everything to be perfect. It'll never happen. But accumulating of good things might lead you to a perfection. So as you said, accumulating of mistakes make you learn. Yes. Just try to learn. That's very inspiring. But now today we're talking to Kip Thorne, one of the biggest minds in the world for gravitational fields. So let's gain from that opportunity. And as you know, our understanding to the universe has been evolving a lot since the old days at Aristotle, Galileo, Newton, Einstein, and now here we are. So I think right now we are the fundamental theory that we use to describe our universe based on gravitational force is general relativity. And the core of general relativity is the space-time fabric, or the space-time manifold fabric, depends how you want to call it. So if you would like you to explain to people, or in your own words, how you vision the space-time. Sometimes I struggle give people the mathematical definition of general relativity or how to simplify it to them.
Well, let me talk about this more generally than just space-time, because I think this is a very important question, but in even more general form. The laws of physics are written in the language of mathematics. And if you really want to understand general relativity deeply, you have to learn differential geometry and differential topology, some rather advanced mathematics. And then if you want to figure out what's going on in some physical situation, such as when something falls into a black hole or two black holes collide, you have to solve equations where the calculations are very complicated, and you may even be driven to having to do simulations on a computer in order to figure things out. And so it's slow. It tends to be slow. And if you want to move at a decent pace, you need some other tool to guide you as to what directions you ought to go, what calculations worth doing, what calculations will really teach you something if you're a theorist, or what experiments are worth doing, what experiments will really teach you something if you're working in the laboratory. And each physicist has his or her own way of answering that. I think we typically use the phrase physical intuition is the thing that guides us. For me, as for Stephen Hawking, who was a close friend, physical intuition is based on mental pictures. I basically, in my everyday work as a physicist, I translated the laws of physics into mental pictures. And I think in terms of mental pictures, what it looks like when black holes collide or when things fall into black holes. And these mental pictures are the guide for what calculations are worth doing. They're the thing that initially tells me what kinds of experiments might be worth doing. Mental pictures, in my case, are absolutely central. And if I work in terms of mental pictures, then I really have a much clearer idea of where I ought to go, what will be a fruitful directions. But I do want to emphasize that different people's minds work differently. So Subramanian Chandrasekhar, who was a very close friend of mine, he emigrated first to England and then to the United States. It was at the University of Chicago, but he was East Indian. He grew up in India. His physical intuition came from looking at the equations and searching for beauty in the equations. I never understood how he could possibly use that to get physical intuition to guide what he did. My mind just didn't work that way, but it was a real lesson for me because he made great discoveries in that way. He discovered in that way, that was the foundations that he built on to discover that there was a maximum mass for a white dwarf star, that if you got something heavier than that, it will probably collapse to form. He asked the question, what? And of course, in the end, we found out a neutron star or a black hole if you made something heavier than that. But he got his insights in this completely different way. And so my piece of advice to people is understand how does your own mind work, and what are the best tools for you for learning, and what are the best tools for you for getting the insights that you need in order to decide what's worth doing.
That's great. I also say, when it comes to that, we are able to make this common sense or this personal image because you rely on the mathematical forms. You are have something to transfer to your mind. And also tell people when they read science for public books, to be careful, what you're getting is a simplified version of what the truth is. So the picture you build in your head you might have a picture in your head, but it's not the truth. It's not what's actual space-time, what's actual black hole is.
And in the end, when I have an insight, when I've decided what direction is worth going, I have to go back to the mathematics in order to clarify it. And I have to go back to experiment and observation in order to truly verify it in the end. And the mistakes that I make are often because my intuition was wrong, but nevertheless, my intuition has been a powerful guide. It told me after a lot of thought and exploration that it would be worthwhile to try to detect gravitational waves. And it was the thing on the basis of which that plus calculations I did to sort of support and build the intuition, the basis of which I decided to devote most of my career to that quest.
That's great. So what if we said to our audience that space-time is everything around us? So it's we are inside the space-time. We are mean Earth, galaxies, black holes. Everything is inside that what we call space-time. And your work was dedicated, as you said now, to the waves that will be traveling through that space-time. So the space-time will have waves traveling through it that we call right now the gravitational waves. So would you like to tell people more about it? How can people...
The gravitational waves are a little different from, say, electromagnetic waves. I would use the phrase electromagnetic waves travel through space-time. But gravitational waves are part of space-time because they are ripples in the geometry of space and time. A gravitational wave stretches space. It is a stretching of space and a squeezing of space. If the gravitational wave is moving from me to you, it stretches in one direction, squeezes in the other direction, but it's a stretch and squeeze of space that can be described in various ways. But if I have two particles that are initially at rest with respect to each other, they're behaving inertially because they're riding on space. The space stretches and squeezes, they move back and forth, which means inertial reference frame here and here, those inertial reference frames, they move back and forth with respect to each other. And so a gravitational wave consists of a stretching and squeezing of space, but it also propagates through space. And so it's a little more complicated and a little more interesting than an electromagnetic wave.
Yeah, that actually, now we discovered based on the LIGO experiment. So first, before I ask more about gravitational waves, how did you feel when you know that the LIGO collaboration, LIGO experiment will be built? And one of the objective is to find what you're proposing.
Well, I should say that I began exploring this possibility 50 years before we discovered gravitational waves. I began thinking about these gravitational waves and exploring them in the 1960s. In 1972, I began developing a vision for what we could do with the waves. It was 1989 that we actually proposed constructing the gravitational wave detectors. 1990-91 that Congress began appropriating money for it. This was a gradual process, and finally yes, saw the waves in 2015. So it was a long process that just basically occupied a very large fraction of my career and that of all my students for a very long period of time. Through the whole thing, it was a joyous process. It was a wonderful collaboration with Ray Weiss at MIT and others. But it was something where we had to fight political battles in Washington. Ultimately won out, but there were a number of powerful people trying to prevent us from doing this because it was costing hundreds of millions of dollars, and they thought it wasn't worth it because they thought we would never see anything. There were ups and downs, there were ups and downs in a process that was overall enormously fun.
No, I can relate. I'm doing nuclear particle physics, quark gluon plasma, early universe stuff, and some stuff like that. And then now we are moving into the new era, which is the electron ion collider. We would like to discover how the quarks inside the protons work. And it might at some point be related to quantum gravity or something, some of it. We can talk about that later. But it's similar right now. We are in this era that we will be building the next generation of accelerators here in the United States at Brookhaven National Laboratory. And we can relate to the ups and downs, the fundings, even the science, what we are looking for, how to look for it. It's thousands of people will be working behind the scene to reach the final goal that you might see in a scientific paper or in the news, but thousands of people have been working behind the scene for that. Scientists, like theoretical people as you, experiments as me, or engineering and even technician, everyone. So that's so great. And I want to go back to the gravitational waves part again. And as you know, we don't know much about the early universe. So we say that's before the cosmic microwave background radiation, we have limited access or no access to that era. Some debates, maybe you know them better than me. But do you think the gravitational waves can contribute to that, or it's out of our reach?
Well, the gravitational waves are extremely penetrating. When we first saw a gravitational wave in 2015, the observational data told us that the gravitational wave came up from the south. It entered the Earth near in Antarctica, traveled through the Earth, and emerged at our gravity wave detectors coming upward from inside the Earth. And we saw them. So it wasn't coming down from the skies. It was coming up from below. And the waves were unaffected by all the matter of the Earth. Similarly, you can make reliable estimates of how penetrating they were in the very early universe. And the bottom line answer is that there was a negligible amount of absorption of gravitational waves or scattering of gravitational waves from the very beginning of the universe until today. And that's incredible. They are far the most penetrating form of radiation that known to us. And that means that whatever kinds of gravitational waves were created in the birth of the universe and quite likely amplified in strength by the process of inflation that we think very likely occurred in the early universe, a very rapid initial expansion. Whatever came off of that, the birth of the universe, and then amplified by inflation, we should be able to see. And there are tentative plans for instruments that will see that. Well, there actually are instruments that are looking at the present time, but looking for primordial waves. This is not LIGO. It's not the kind of gravity wave detector I've worked on, but rather those primordial gravitational waves are thought to have interacted with the hot plasma of the early universe at the time the plasma was recombining, so that it was becoming neutral, and are thought to have placed, and that's when the cosmic microwave background was released, last interacted with matter. And the gravitational waves are thought to have put a polarization, a very particular polarization pattern on the cosmic microwave background. That pattern's being searched for, it has been seen, but there's noise in the data. And that data have to be understood and the noise removed. But I think that will be successfully done in this decade. So by about 2030, we may well then have an observation of the primordial gravitational waves through the imprint that they put on the cosmic microwave background. So that's fabulous. But even more interesting is in the 2050 time frame, there's likely to be a space mission, a follow-on mission to the planned LISA gravity wave mission, a second generation gravity wave mission, currently called the Big Bang Observer, which should directly see the gravitational waves at periods of a few seconds, very, very different period than the periods of the waves that you see through the cosmic microwave background. And so I think it's quite likely that we will see, by the middle of this century, we will see the gravitational waves in these two different frequency bands. One very, very long periods that is the polarization pattern, and the other very short periods. We will be using them to try to decipher what was happening in the Big Bang in the earliest moments of the universe. So that for me is sort of the holy grail of this field for the period, for the epoch of the middle of this century.
That's great. I'm too happy to hear it. That's something we want to see, it for sure, understanding our early universe, how the universe evolved, how we came to this, where we are right now. That's a lot of questions to answer. Gravitational waves is the one to do it, for sure. That's, I remember when the first discovery just was released, when I sit and talk to people that's doing quantum gravity or gravitational physics, the main thing was saying, we are entering a new era of cosmology. Everything will be different from now on. So we're looking for it. But now we talked about science a bit. I want to take you to the next step in your in our podcast today, which will be your science communication.
Let me just back up briefly, linger on gravitational waves just for a moment first. And that is to emphasize something you emphasized about the area you're working in. The ultimate success in this was the result of the combined efforts of more than 1,000 people. It was the younger generation, not my generation, that really pulled it off technically. Although we got it started, although my generation was still involved in one way or another, it was really the next generation that made this thing happen. But it was a collaboration also with the Congress, that both Republicans and Democrats supported this project once we started getting the large funds, supported it for 25 years from when we first got construction funds until we saw the waves. And the members of both parties took great pride in the discovery. It was, of course, the staff at the National Science Foundation, through which the funds came, that were absolutely crucial and absolutely phenomenal in this whole thing. It really is something that I think so many people around the world can take enormous pride in it, and it is, and I would highlight particularly Barry Barish, who was the LIGO director who pulled everything together organizationally and set us on our route to success once we had gotten the funding. Under the leadership of a previous director, we got the initial funding, Robbie Vogt. But I think the people that were so crucial from my point of view were Barry Barish, the key director that who made the thing take off, and Ray Weiss, the experimenter with whom I collaborated so closely and so beautifully through the whole thing. And he was the primary inventor of these gravity wave detectors.
I fully agree. It's not only scientists. Scientists is one important key. Having the mind is one important key. Having the decision makers is another very important key. Having the funding agency and the work happening every year from them is another important key, and having the international collaborations behind that is also a key of success. So putting all of those together, that's what's make that nation is one leading nation in scientific discoveries. That's really important. That's how I feel about it and I see it. Thanks so much. And so, as I said, like many people would be interesting to hear about the science communication part, but I would like to ask how you get into that. You know, when I first heard about Caltech, it's way before I come to the science field, it was through the Big Bang Theory, the first early days. And you can tell that. So that being at least linked to you guys there at Caltech.
Well, let me just say that in many circles, I am famous above all for having had a speaking role on the Big Bang Theory.
And
I was on one episode of the Big Bang Theory, and I said, no, that was my speaking role, no. and that was enough to make me famous.
that's one of the things that I first saw physics, some of it through the Big Bang Theory, or at least some of what I'm interested about, the particle physics in general. And then, good. So that's being at Caltech happening. Does this impact you? It was before that you thought about the science communication, or after that? Does it play any role at all?
Well, I was interested in science communication right from the beginning, even before I became a physicist. And so throughout my career, I spent some portion of my energies on science communication to non-scientists, and I encouraged my students to also do that and to develop the skill of being able to communicate to non-scientists about what they're doing. That's very important. That we both owe it to our fellow citizens because they are the source of funding they are also the source of the young people that we train to become physicists. And so our enterprise is, in some sense, a collaboration with the general public. I'm most well known, I think, in terms of science communication for the role I played in the movie Interstellar, as you were probably about to.
Yes, I know it's one of the, as I said, many people get to very interested about Interstellar and how the science being baked into the story of the not only physics, but I think also some biology, some geology there too. Like some physics was the main layer. But also, you mentioned before that you it was more than science community, or at least the science advisor for the movie. I think you start by writing something first. That's you called it the warping side of the universe before the new book, of course.
Yeah, so what happened, this movie was an outgrowth, actually, of a failed romance. Carl Sagan, who was a close friend of mine, introduced me to a movie producer named Linda Obst in 1979, a long time ago. And Linda and I dated, but in the end, I was too much of a nerd for her, and she was too intense for me, but we became close friends. And so I advised a little bit on her, on Carl Sagan's movie and her movie. She was a producer, Contact. And then after Carl had died, sadly, a few years later, she phoned me up and asked if I would like to brainstorm with her for a movie. And I said, sure, that would be fun. And maybe through a movie, I could inspire a lot of people about science. And so we did that. We brainstormed, and the movie became Interstellar. So that's how it started, just with her and me. But in the end, of course, it was the Nolan brothers, Christopher Nolan, his brother, Jonathan Nolan, who made this movie really a fabulous success. Linda and I wrote what's called a treatment for the movie, which was a description of a story and characters, but in our case also of the science that was embedded in the movie from the start. And that became the thing on which this Jonathan Nolan, as a screenwriter, took off from our treatment that we wrote. And he and his brother, Christopher Nolan, changed the story almost completely, changed the characters, but kept the science. The movie we began with, Linda and I, had the heroes going through a wormhole to a vicinity of a black hole and some adventures there and return. So it was similar in that respect, but the human story was quite different. And because the Nolan brothers are superb storytellers, and that's not my great skill, but it was a collaboration in which I brainstormed first with Linda, then with Jonathan Nolan, and then with Christopher Nolan for the science underlying the movie. And when it came to the biology, Linda Obst and I brought in a set of biologists. We actually had a dinner with lots of wine and free-flowing discussion and a tape recorder sitting in the middle of the table. And we discussed the issue of what could be the science underlying the necessity for humanity to move off of the Earth.
Yeah. If you can fix it over here, you don't need to go to space. Like, getting to outer space is way complicated than doing things.
Why should it be so bad that you can't fix it and you've got to
go
up? And so all the biology in there really came from advice from, in particular, in this long dinner. It was a 3 or 4 hour dinner at the Caltech Faculty Club, of brainstorming together with the biologists. And throughout the whole process, we brought in the very best experts on the relevant science, and we brainstormed with them. So In the end, this movie really is based on real science to a degree that is perhaps unmatched by any movie, but the other movies that come close to it would be Contact and 2001, A Space Odyssey, and more recently, The Martian. So there, and that's about it. 2001, followed by Contact, followed by Interstellar, followed by The Martian would be the set of movies that I can point to that are deeply based on real science.
That's great. Like, you know, seeing this scientific pictures turned into like a movie, not only that people can relate to it in drama, but also in science. As you said, the science had been baked into a human story, a human being story, the story of humanity. How can we save the humanity at the end? But that's also, you know, when I was digging online for some questions, asking people that already online with us or here, what they would like to ask you about the Interstellar. And first, you know, we can come up with three key aspects. You can correct me on that, of course. The time dilation is one of them, and that was baked into the music of the movie. The wormhole space traveling, and the black hole, and that's the one that most people at least need some explanation on. So let's take them one by one. In the movie, let's start by the time dilation.
Yeah, so well, the time dilation, of course, the movie describes the time dilation very powerfully because you see Murph, Cooper's daughter. You meet Murph when she's about 10 years old, early in the movie. And then you see her quite extensively when she's has become a physicist. And she's working together God, it's so long since I've looked at that. Anyway, so she's become a physicist and is working on trying to understand the gravitational anomalies in order as a tool for trying to understand how to save humanity. And then you see her as a very old lady at the very at the end of the movie. And in that whole process, Cooper has only aged by an amount of a couple of years in that entire process, while she has moved from age 10 to age 95. And so something has gone crazy about time, and that is time dilation. The thing that was particularly most interesting for me on the time dilation was when Christopher Nolan said to me, I want 1 hour down on the surface of Miller's planet, the water planet in the movie, to correspond to 7 years up at high orbit and back on Earth. And I said to him immediately, that's not possible, because any planet that's as close enough to a black hole to have that much time dilation, it will surely be in an unstable orbit and will fall into the black hole and be gone. He said, Chris said to me, by then he knew me quite well, he said, okay, well, that's your initial answer, but you could well be wrong. Go do a real calculation. Don't just use your intuition. Go do the mathematical calculation. So I did. And I discovered that he was right and I was wrong. That in fact, if the black hole is spinning fast enough, then in some sense, the centrifugal forces associated with the dragging of space into motion, the so-called frame dragging, they enable the planet to still be in a stable orbit around the black hole, close enough to the black hole that indeed 1 hour on the planet that close to the black hole is 7 years back on Earth. But it's a beautiful example of the true answer comes from a detailed calculation of the laws of physics, not my physical intuition, which was wrong, and or from observation. Well, you see the observation in the movie.
That's great. And so our next step will be, as I said, the wormhole. So usually we think, or people, If you saw any of these sci-fi movies, they say, okay, we're going to the wormhole. But what happens? Like, I remember one of my friends that worked in the field, he tried to describe it as a tunnel in space, but not time. Can we say something like that?
Yeah, you know, that's... So the wormhole that appears in the movie Interstellar, that is basically right. There is no significant amount of time dilation in the wormhole, but it is a tunnel in space or a tunnel through the higher dimensions, through what a physicist would call the bulk, to enable you to get from one region of our universe to another. It's a shortcut through the higher dimension. And wormholes were first explored in general relativity by Einstein himself and Nathan Rosen, who was a young colleague of his, in 1935. They came to be called at that point an Einstein-Rosen bridge. It was John Wheeler who changed the name to wormhole, and thinking of the wormhole through an apple as being an analogy for to get by a shorter route from one side of an apple to another. But the mathematics of wormholes was pretty clear already to Einstein and Rosen in 1935. But what they did not know, and Wheeler and his collaborators discovered, was that wormholes are unstable in the sense that a wormhole will pinch off very quickly. If you don't do something special to prevent it from pinching off, it'll pinch off before you can travel through, even if you're traveling through at the speed of light. And so when Carl Sagan said he wanted to go through a black hole in the movie Contact to get to the star Vega, I said, no, you have to, let's use a wormhole, but you have to have a way to hold the wormhole open, or else it will implode. And that's when I, together with my students, began work on the issue of holding wormholes open. And that's been a major research effort among experts in relativity for several decades. We know that to hold a wormhole open, you have to thread it, put into its interior something that repels gravitationally, basically holds the wormhole open through a gravitational repulsion. And we know that you can make such stuff that repels gravitationally. It is something that has negative energy. And you can get negative energy by modifying vacuum fluctuations. So the key is vacuum fluctuations, which occur in quantum theory. If you take a box, remove everything you possibly can remove, the stuff that's left is fluctuations of virtual particles, virtual protons and electrons, fluctuating in and out of existence inside of it. And those vacuum fluctuations, if you modify them appropriately, you can wind up with one region of space that has reduced vacuum fluctuations, repels gravitationally, another region that has increased fluctuations, attracts gravitationally. And so the whole theory of vacuum fluctuations becomes a foundation for really understanding holding wormholes open and many other topics in the universe. And so that's the bottom line of all the research that's been done on this, I think, is that it's quite likely that you cannot put enough reduced vacuum fluctuations inside a wormhole to hold it open. But we still don't know that for sure. And it still is an open question.
That's a very interesting to hear about it, because as you said, as long as I heard about wormhole, I know it's unstable and it's going to be collapsing. People can imagine it as a vacuum tube, sort of, that will squash. And then you need to find a way to make it still open. And this is where the idea of the quantum fluctuations comes into the game. And I wonder if you will be writing a book about that. Let's say the wormhole is an interesting topic itself.
I actually have... so I have this book of my poetry and paintings by Leah Halloran, your great painter, came out about a year ago, that it covers many aspects of warp space-time, but not vacuum fluctuations. We have an addendum on vacuum fluctuations that we've been working on I'm enthusiastic about, but it's not ready for prime time yet. but and we don't know in what form we're going to put it out, but vacuum fluctuations are an absolutely beautiful subject in physics, and in cosmology and in modern technology. They're the foundation for quantum technology, for modern quantum technology.
And yeah, for our audience, this is the book givers are referring to, if I understood it correctly. Yeah. It's going to be hard, but it's a warping side of our universe. It's this book over here. It's a new book. I encourage everyone to read it. Have been enjoying looking to it the last couple of weeks. The orbit side of our universe. And you will find a very interesting pictures about it inside, how the spinning black holes are working and many other very nice artistic work too. So
let me just say of this book was really an experiment to try to see if we could develop a new way of communicating science to non-scientists. And this way is this mixture of verse and paintings, tightly integrated, tightly coupled. And I think my conclusion from it and from people's reaction to it is that it really is a powerful way to convey the basic ideas behind a topic in science such as warp space time. But if you want to go into detail, it's not as good as more ordinary kinds of science communication. But to get an initial introduction to a topic like black holes and wormholes and gravitational waves, for people who are very far from it, it's a very powerful way to give this initial introduction.
I fully agree, especially you add the, I wouldn't say the picture, but you add the vision over there. You can see in the background of the blast, the artistic work of how an artist can picture your words. So I can see it as two people try to bring the two worlds together, the art world and the science world together. And also, since we are at the topic, I would like to remind everyone that there are a book already outside, The Science of Interstellar. That can be visible over here. So The Science of Interstellar is related to the movie Interstellar, explaining the physics of Interstellar into details. So if anyone likes the movie, want to know more about it, that's the book. Find it online through Amazon or anything else. So that's pretty interesting. So my last question related to this part, Kev, was related to the black hole. What's happening in the vicinity of black hole? I know that we have the event horizon and then out of that. Do we understand what's happening after the event horizon? Everything happened in the movie was before that part.
Yeah, so, well, you know, in the movie, Cooper does go inside the event horizon. You see him go inside, you see him turn around, and the camera turns around, looks out from inside the black hole, and you see the universe above in a narrow circle above, which is how things are, because basically everything involving the black holes and the wormholes that you see in the movie is based on computer simulations that were done solving the equations for the propagation of light through and around wormholes and black holes. But anyway, the black hole then in Interstellar, however, is an accurate representation of what it would really look like if the black hole is surrounded by a thin disk of hot gas. That's not the way that black holes normally occur in the well, let me start over again. Since the movie Interstellar came out, the Event Horizon Telescope has made images of black holes, observational images. They look somewhat similar, but not exactly the same, because the gas is moving in three dimensions. It's not a thin disk in the equator. And so I'm very eager to see movies in that of from the Event Horizon Telescope, which will show us then the flow of the hot gas around the black hole and how magnetic fields influence that flow. It'll be really, really wonderful coming out sometime in the next few years. But The physics of the black holes in the movie is really not very rich compared to the physics of black holes that we have in LIGO when black holes collide. In the movies, you do see, and you have a little bit of discussion of the fact that there are three singularities in the interior. That's a prediction. Of course, we don't have observational data, though Cooper did get some observational data when he went in, and
yes, for the first time.
He came back not by going out through the horizon, but going up into the fifth dimension and coming back through the bulk. So all the stuff that you see about black holes in the movie is really as accurate as it can be based on what our current knowledge of black holes. But when black holes collide, there's an enormous greater richness that you just never see in Interstellar. The black holes have sticking out of themselves two vortices of twisting space. When black holes collide and merge, you wind up with four vortices sticking out of the black holes. Black holes don't like to have four vortices. And so two of them have to get ejected. And the whole dynamics of what goes on with these vortices of twisting space when black holes collide is really very interesting. We have learned about these things from computer simulations that were done at the same time as I was writing this book on the warp side of the universe, and the same time as LIGO was gearing up on the verge of making its observations, and at the same time as Interstellar was being filmed. And so we have today a understanding of a richness of behavior of black holes that in fact is discussed in my book with Leah Halloran, the paintings and verse book, that's not in other books about black holes because it's too new. But it's an understanding that is in that book because most of this understanding came from computer simulations, solving Einstein's equations on computers by a research group that I helped to start that is a collaboration largely between Caltech and Cornell universities, but also computer simulations by other groups around the world. And it's all very new and all very wonderful. And you will start seeing this in other non-technical books. The first non-technical book that really describes that is my Warped Side of the Universe book.
That's another point to emphasize that. I would like to encourage everybody to take a look at the book, The Warping Side of Our Universe. I did like the pictures, I'd like the simple explanation. You really will see a different perspective of the black holes spinning and everything you can imagine. And as Kev said, it's the most recent one. And Kev, we have been diving with you through your journey, how it starts, how you become a physicist, and also to the physics of the gravitational waves and the physics of the movie Interstellar. And I would like to ask you if you would like to direct an advice to the young generation of physicists. Of course, you're still young, but let's see.
The young generation. Yes, at 84, I'm still young. Yes, thank you.
Time is relative. I don't need to tell you that. So if you'd like to say an advice to the young generations of physicists and also the public audience that's listening to us today, I think the floor is yours.
Well, I think one piece of advice that is very precious to me is advice I first got from my grandfather, my mother's father, when I was 4 years old. And he said to me, Kip, if when you grow up, you get a job that's like play, you can be a big success. And so let me elaborate on that now as an adult, looking back on that advice that he gave to me. I interpret this as meaning that you really need to, in the end, when you decide what to do with in your life and in career, pick things. If you want to really do something really interesting, and you want to have an impact on the world, to do that is hard. You have to work very hard. And if you don't work very hard, you're not likely to succeed. But in order to work hard, Successfully, it helps enormously if you're having fun. And so when my granddaughter decided she was going to be a physicist, I told her, you don't love it enough. You're not going to have enough fun. So you use it as a springboard, and you get your PhD as you're planning to do in physics, and then move in some other direction. There's so many directions you can go, and you'll find something that is enormous fun, and then you'll be a huge success because you'll love it so much that you'll work really hard and you'll be driven by your curiosity and by your enthusiasm. Well, in fact, in her case, she did find a PhD thesis that turned her on, and she was got enthusiastic. I don't tell her anymore to leave the field, but it is my very strong advice that when you decide what you're going to do, what directions you're going to do, a big piece of the thing, the big factor in making a decision is to pick direction that you're going to enjoy. Life is short. You should enjoy it anyway. But if you're going to succeed, having fun at it is a key to success.
That's great to hear. I hope everyone listened to that advice and take it to the heart. I really appreciate it. I will do that myself. And since we are at the end of it, you know, this podcast, when I first moved here, I'm very recent to the Texas Southern University. I get a lot of help from my, I'll say, like seniors, professors over here. This is my third month at the university. And when I mentioned the idea of the podcast to introduce it to our community, they was very supportive. The university management, my department chair, even my, like I'll say, senior professors in the department. And then we all together come together and try to choose a gift for you that could come from us. So I would like to ask Mark, if you could come, Dr. Mark Harvey and Dr. Kaus. So I invite them to say hi to you, and we introduce you our gift from Texas Southern University.
Well, thank you.
Good day, Dr. Thorne. My name is Mark Harvey here at Texas Southern, of course, and I'm a professor of physics.
Hi, I'm Carlos Handy, sort of the founding father of this department. I'm very happy to know 84 is still young, because I'm 74. I want to know I got something to look forward to. But anyway, we're obviously gratified and extremely pleased that we're hosting this, and certainly your comments are extremely welcome, especially your advice for younger people, students interested in physics. It's very, very much welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure, and great questions and wonderful discussion. I've greatly enjoyed it.
Okay. Excuse me, Dr. Thorne. I do have one quick question, perhaps. If there's an Interstellar movie part two, what physics updates would you include in such a remake, as it were?
Well, there won't be an Interstellar part two, because Christopher Nolan makes that decision, and he made it a while back. I think he wants to go in other directions. But if I were moving on to do a sci-fi movie and wanting to ask what other physics would I put in, well, I would keep this kind of physics that Interstellar has. But the other thing that I would add is quantum information science, quantum computing, quantum cryptography, the issue of entanglement. There's so many weird phenomena in quantum physics. If you imagine a very advanced civilization that has the technology to really do remarkable things in quantum physics, well, I could imagine a movie that is really exciting that brings that into the mix.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. So we'll be sending that, but we'd like to share it with you. That's a Texas Southern University t-shirt.
Great. And
we Thank have you. Also, that's for your desk with the Texas Southern University on the glass. It's one of our appreciation. It's for your being with us today. And that's from our VP for that makes all that happening, Dr. Michelle Byrne Marshall. So I'd like to thank you so much, Ken, for that opportunity.
Thank you. And thank you.
I would like to thank everybody that was here today, everyone that was online. Guys, this is how we practice science every day. That's why science is important and very interesting. As Kip said at the end, for us, it's like a game that we take responsibly. We really learn from it, and we try to shape the world around us. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, and a great pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Thor.
Have a nice rest of your day, everyone.